in part. His strength, which you admire, is the product of my training."
"The strength of a woman can be boundless," Stilgar said. "Certain it is in a reverend mother. Are you a reverend mother?"
For the moment, Jessica put aside the implications of the question, answered truthfully, "No."
"Are you trained in the ways of the desert?"
"No, but many consider my training valuable."
"We make our own judgments on value," Stilgar said.
"Every man has the right to his own judgments," she said.
"It is well that you see the reason," Stilgar said. "We cannot dally here to test you, woman. Do you understand? We'd not want your shade to plague us. I will take the boy man, your son, and he shall have my countenance, sanctuary in my tribe. But for you, woman, you understand there is nothing personal in this? It is the rule, Istisla, in the general interest. Is that not enough?"
Paul took a half step forward. "What are you talking about?" Stilgar flicked a glance across Paul but kept his attention on Jessica.
"Unless you've been deep trained from childhood to live here, you cannot bring destruction onto an entire tribe. It is the law, and we cannot carry useless—"
Jessica's motion started as a slumping, deceptive faint to the ground. It was the obvious thing for a weak outworlder to do, and the obvious slows an opponent's reactions. It takes an instant to interpret a known thing when that thing is exposed as something unknown. She shifted as she saw his right shoulder drop to bring a weapon within the folds of his robe to bear on her new position. A turn, a slash of her arm, a whirling of mingled robes, and she was against the rocks with the man helpless in front of her. At his mother's first movement, Paul backed two steps. As she attacked, he dove for shadows. A bearded man rose up in his path, half crouched, lunging forward with a weapon in one hand. Paul took the man beneath the sternum with a straight hand jab, sidestepped and chopped the base of his neck, relieving him of the weapon as he fell. Then Paul was into the shadows, scrambling upward among the rocks, the weapon tucked into his waist sash. He had recognized it in spite of its unfamiliar shape, a projectile weapon, and that said many things about this place. Another clue that shields were not used here.
"They will concentrate on my mother and that Stilgar fellow. She can handle him. I must get to a safe vantage point where I can threaten them and give her time to escape."
There came a chorus of sharp spring clicks from the basin. Projectiles whined off the rocks around him. One of them flicked his robe. He squeezed around a corner in the rocks, found himself in a narrow vertical crack, began inching upward, his back against one side, his feet against the other, slowly, as silently as he could. The roar of Stilgar's voice echoed up to him.
"Get back, you worm-headed lice! She'll break my neck if you come near!"
A voice out of the basin said,
"The boy got away still. What are we—"
"Of course he got away, you sand-brained—" "Ugh! Easy, woman!"
"Tell them to stop hunting my son," Jessica said.
"They've stopped, woman. He got away as you intended him to. Great gods below, why didn't you say you were a weirding woman and a fighter?"
"Tell your men to fall back," Jessica said. "Tell them to go out into the basin where I can see them. And you'd better believe that I know how many of them there are."
And she thought, this is the delicate moment. But if this man is as sharp-minded as I think him, we have a chance. Paul inched his way upward, found a narrow ledge on which he could rest and look down into the basin. Stilgar's voice came up to him.
"And if I refuse, how can you—" "Leave be, woman! We mean no harm to you. Now, great gods, if you can do this to the strongest of us, you're worth 10 times your weight of water."
Now the test of reason, Jessica thought. She said, "You ask after the Lisan al-Ghaib."
"You could be the folk of the legend," he said, "but I'll believe that when it's been tested. All I know now is that you came here with that stupid duke who—" "Aye, woman! I care not if you kill me. He was honorable and brave, but it was stupid to put himself in the way of the Harkonnen fist."
Silence. Presently, Jessica said,
"He had no choice. But we'll not argue it. Now, tell that man of yours behind the bush over there to stop trying to bring his weapon to bear on me, or I'll rid the universe of you and take him next."
"You there!" Stilgar roared. "Do as she says!"
"But still—" Do as she says, you worm-faced, crawling, sand-brained piece of lizard turd! Do it, or I'll help her dismember you. Can't you see the worth of this woman?
The man at the bush straightened from his partial concealment, lowered his weapon.
He has obeyed, Stilgar said.
Now, Jessica said, explain clearly to your people what it is you wish of me. I want no young hothead to make a foolish mistake.
When we slip into the villages and towns, we must mask our origin, blend with the Pan and Graben folk, Stilgar said. We carry no weapons, for the Chris knife is sacred. But you, woman, you have the wielding ability of battle. We'd only heard of it, and many doubted, but one cannot doubt what he sees with his own eyes. You mastered an armed Fremen. This is a weapon no search could expose.
There was a stirring in the basin as Stilgar's words sank home.
And if I agree to teach you the wielding way?
My countenance for you, as well as your son.
How can we be sure of the truth in your promise?
Stilgar's voice lost some of its subtle undertone of reasoning, took on an edge of bitterness.
Out here, woman, we carry no paper for contracts. We make no evening promises to be broken at dawn. When a man says a thing, that's the contract. As leader of my people, I've put them in bond to my word. Teach us this wielding way, and you have sanctuary with us as long as you wish. Your water shall mingle with our water.
Can you speak for all Fremen? Jessica asked.
In time, that may be. But only my brother, Liet, speaks for all Fremen. Here I promise only secrecy. My people will not speak of you to any other Sietch. The Harkonnens have returned to Dune in force, and your duke is dead. It is said that you two died in a mother storm. The hunter does not seek dead game.
There's a safety in that, Jessica thought. But these people have good communications, and a message could be sent. I presume there was a reward offered for us, she said.
Stilgar remained silent, and she could almost see the thoughts turning over in his head, sensing the shifts of his muscles beneath her hands. Presently he said,
I will say it once more. I've given the tribe's word bond. My people know your worth to us now. What could the Harkonnens give us? Our freedom? Ha! No, you are the Tok'wa, that which buys us more than all the spice in the Harkonnen coffers.
Then I shall teach you my way of battle, Jessica said. And she sensed the unconscious ritual intensity of her own words.
Now, will you release me?
So be it, Jessica said.
She released her hold on him, stepped aside in full view of the bank in the basin.
This is the test, Masht, she thought. But Paul must know about them, even if I die for his knowledge.
In the waiting silence, Paul inched forward to get a better view of where his mother stood. As he moved, he heard heavy breathing suddenly stilled above him in the vertical crack of the rock and sensed a faint shadow there outlined against the stars. Stilgar's voice came up from the basin.
You up there! Stop hunting the boy! He'll come down presently!
The voice of a young boy or a girl sounded from the darkness above Paul.
But still, he can't be far from—
I said leave him be, Cheney, you spawn of a lizard.
There came a whispered imprecation from above Paul and a low voice.
Call me spawn of a lizard.
But the shadow pulled back out of view. Paul returned his attention to the basin, picking out the grey shadowed movement of Stilgar beside his mother.
Come in, all of you, Stilgar called.
He turned to Jessica.
And now I'll ask you how we may be certain you'll fulfill your half of our bargain. You're the ones lived with papers and empty contracts and such as—
We of the Bene Gesserit don't break our vows any more than you do, Jessica said.
There was a protracted silence, then a multiple hissing of voices.
A Bene Gesserit witch!
Paul brought his captured weapon from his sash, trained it on the dark figure of Stilgar. But the man and his companions remained immobile, staring at Jessica.
It is the legend, someone said.
It was said that the Shaddout Mapes gave this report on you, Stilgar said. But a thing so important must be tested.
If you are the Bene Gesserit of the legend whose son will lead us to paradise...
He shrugged. Jessica sighed, thinking, so a missionaria protectiva even planted religious safety valves all through this hellhole. Ah well, it'll help, and that's what it was meant to do. She said, the seeress who brought you the legend, she gave it under the binding of Karama and Ijaz, the miracle and the inimitability of the prophecy. This I know. Do you wish a sign? His nostrils flared in the moonlight.
We cannot tarry for the rites, he whispered.
Jessica recalled a chart Kynes had shown her while arranging emergency escape routes. How long ago, it seemed. There had been a place called Siech Tabor on the chart, and beside it the notation, Stilgar. Perhaps when we get to Siech Tabor, she said. The revelation shook him, and Jessica thought, if only he knew the tricks we use. She must have been good, that Bene Gesserit of the Missionaria Protectiva. These Fremen are beautifully prepared to believe in us. Stilgar shifted uneasily.
We must go now.
She nodded, letting him know that they left with her permission. He looked up at the cliff, almost directly at the rock ledge where Paul crouched.
You there, lad! You may come down now!
He returned his attention to Jessica, spoke with an apologetic tone.
Your son made an incredible amount of noise climbing. He has much to learn lest he endanger us all. But he's young.
No doubt we have much to teach each other, Jessica said. Meanwhile, you'd best see to your companion out there. My noisy son was a bit rough in disarming him.
Stilgar whirled, his hood flapping.
Where?
Beyond those bushes, she pointed.
Stilgar touched two of his men.
See to it.
He glanced at his companions, identifying them.
Jamis is missing.
He turned to Jessica.
Even your cub knows the weirding way.
And you'll notice that my son hasn't stirred from up there as you ordered, Jessica said.
The two men Stilgar had sent returned, supporting a third, who stumbled and gasped between them. Stilgar gave them a flicking glance, returned his attention to Jessica.
The son will take only your orders, eh? Good. He knows discipline.
Paul, you may come down now, Jessica said.
Paul stood up, emerging into moonlight above his concealing cleft, slipped the Fremen weapon back into his sash. As he turned, another figure arose from the rocks to face him. In the moonlight and reflection off grey stone, Paul saw a small figure in Fremen robes, a shadowed face peering out at him from the hood, and the muzzle of one of the projectile weapons aimed at him from a fold of robe.
I am Chaney, daughter of Liet.
The voice was lilting, half filled with laughter.
I would not have permitted you to harm my companions, she said.
Paul swallowed. The figure in front of him turned into the moon's path, and he saw an elfin face, black pits of eyes. The familiarity of that face, the features out of numberless visions in his earliest prescience, shocked Paul to stillness. He remembered the angry bravado with which he had once described this face from a dream, telling the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, I will meet her. And here was the face. But in no meeting he had ever dreamed.
You were as noisy as Shaihulud in a rage, she said, and you took the most difficult way up here. Follow me. I'll show you an easier way down.
He scrambled out of the cleft, followed the swirling of her robe across a tumbled landscape. She moved like a gazelle, dancing over the rocks. Paul felt hot blood in his face, was thankful for the darkness.
That girl!
She was like a touch of destiny. He felt caught up on a wave, in tune with a motion that lifted all his spirits. They stood presently amidst the Fremen on the basin floor. Jessica turned a wry smile on Paul, but spoke to Stilgar.
This will be a good exchange of teachings. I hope you and your people feel no anger at our violence. It seemed necessary. You were about to
make a mistake.
To save one from a mistake is a gift of paradise, Stilgar said.
He touched his lips with his left hand, lifted the weapon from Paul's waist with the other, tossed it to a companion.
You will have your own Mauler pistol, lad, when you've earned it.
Paul started to speak, hesitated, remembering his mother's teaching. Beginnings are such delicate times.
My son has what weapons he needs, Jessica said.
She stared at Stilgar, forcing him to think of how Paul had acquired the pistol. Stilgar glanced at the man Paul had subdued, Jameis. The man stood at one side, head lowered, breathing heavily.
You are a difficult woman, Stilgar said.
He held out his left hand to a companion, snapped his fingers.
Kushti bakate!
More Chakopsa, Jessica thought. The companion pressed two squares of gauze into Stilgar's hand. Stilgar ran them through his fingers, fixed one around Jessica's neck beneath her hood, fitted the other around Paul's neck in the same way.
Now you wear the kerchief of the Baka, he said. If we become separated, you will be recognized as belonging to Stilgar's Sietch. We will talk of weapons another time.
He moved out through his band now, inspecting them, giving Paul's Fremkit pack to one of his men to carry.
Baka, Jessica thought, recognizing the religious term, Baka, the weeper.
She sensed how the symbolism of the kerchiefs united this band.
Why should weeping unite them? She asked herself.
Stilgar came to the young girl who had embarrassed Paul, said,
Jenny, take the child man under your wing. Keep him out of trouble.
Cheney touched Paul's arm.
Come along, child man.
Paul hid the anger in his voice, said,
My name is Paul. It were well you—
We'll give you a name, manling, Stilgar said, in the time of the Mina, at the test of Akl.
The test of reason, Jessica translated. The sudden need of Paul's ascendancy overrode all other consideration, and she barked,
My son's been tested with the Gomjabar.
In the stillness that followed, she knew she had struck to the heart of them.
There's much we don't know of each other, Stilgar said. But we tarry over long. Day sun mustn't find us in the open.
He crossed to the man Paul had struck down, said,
Jameis, can you travel?
A grunt answered him.
Surprised me he did. 'Twas an accident. I can travel.
No accident, Stilgar said. I'll hold you responsible with Cheney for the lad's safety, Jameis. These people have my countenance.
Jessica stared at the man Jameis. His was the voice that had argued with Stilgar from the rocks. His was the voice with death in it. And Stilgar had seen fit to reinforce his order with this Jameis. Stilgar flicked a testing glance across the group, motioned two men out.
Larus and Farouk, you are to hide our tracks. See that we leave no trace. Extra care. We have two with us who've not been trained.
He turned, hand upheld, and aimed across the basin.
In squad line with flankers. Move out. We must be at Cave of the Ridges before dawn.
Jessica fell into step beside Stilgar, counting heads. There were 40 Fremen. She and Paul made it 42, and she thought, they travel as a military company. Even the girl, Cheney. Paul took a place in the line behind Cheney. He had put down the black feeling at being caught by the girl. In his mind now was the memory called up by his mother's barked reminder, My son's been tested with a Gomjabar. He found that his hand tingled with remembered pain.
Watch where you go, Cheney hissed. Do not brush against a bush, lest you leave a thread to show our passage.
Paul swallowed, nodded. Jessica listened to the sounds of the troop, hearing her own footsteps and Paul's, marveling at the way the Fremen moved. There were 40 people crossing the basin with only the sounds natural to the place, ghostly feluccas, their robes flitting through the shadows. Their destination was Sietch Tabor, Stilgar's Sietch. She turned the word over in her mind. Sietch. It was a Chakobsa word. Unchanged from the old hunting language out of countless centuries. Sietch, a meeting place in time of danger.
The profound implications of the word and the language were just beginning to register with her after the tension of their encounter.
"We move well," Stilgar said. "With Shai-Hulud's favor, we'll reach Cave of the Ridges before dawn."
Jessica nodded, conserving her strength, sensing the terrible fatigue she held at bay by force of will, and, she admitted it, by the force of elation. Her mind focused on the value of this troop, seeing what was revealed here about the Fremen culture. All of them, she thought. An entire culture trained to military order. What a priceless thing is here for an outcast duke.
The Fremen were supreme in that quality the ancients called Spallensporgen, which is the self-imposed delay between desire for a thing and the act of reaching out to grasp that thing. From the Wisdom of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
They approached Cave of the Ridges at dawnbreak, moving through a split in the basin wall so narrow they had to turn sideways to negotiate it. Jessica saw Stilgar, detached guards in the thin dawnlight, saw them for a moment as they began their scrambling climb up the cliff. Paul turned his head upward as he walked, seeing the tapestry of this planet cut in cross-section with a narrow cleft gaped toward grey-blue sky. Chaney pulled at his rope to hurry him, said,
"Quickly, it is already light." "The men who climbed above us, where are they going?"
Paul whispered.
"The first day watch," she said. "Hurry now."
A guard left outside, Paul thought. Wise. But it would have been wiser still for us to approach this place in separate bands, less chance of losing the whole troop. He paused in the thought, realizing that this was guerrilla thinking, and he remembered his father's fear that the Atreides might become a guerrilla house.
"Faster," Chaney whispered.
Paul sped his steps, heard the swish of robes behind, and he thought of the words of the Sirat from Yui's tiny OC Bible. "Paradise on my right, hell on my left, and the angel of death behind." He rolled the quotation in his mind. They rounded a corner where the passage widened. Stilgar stood at one side, motioning them into a low hole that opened at right angles.
"Quickly," he hissed. "We're like rabbits in a cage if a patrol catches us here."
Paul bent for the opening, followed Chaney into a cave illuminated by thin grey light from somewhere ahead.
"You can stand up," she said.
He straightened, studied the place. A deep and wide area with domed ceiling that curved away just out of a man's hand reach. The troop spread out through shadows. Paul saw his mother come up on one side, saw her examine their companions. And he noted how she failed to blend with the Fremen even though her garb was identical. The way she moved, such a sense of power and grace.
"Find a place to rest and stay out of the way, child man," Chaney said. "Here's food."
She pressed two leaf-wrapped morsels into his hand. They reeked of spice. Stilgar came up behind Jessica, called an order to a group on the left.
"Get the door seal in place and see to moisture security."
He turned to another Fremen.
"Lemiel, get glow globes."
He took Jessica's arm.
"I wish to show you something, weirding woman."
He led her around a curve of rock toward the light source. Jessica found herself looking out across the wide lip of another opening to the cave, an opening high in a cliff wall, looking out across another basin about 10 or 12 kilometers wide. The basin was shielded by high rock walls. Sparse clumps of plant growth were scattered around it. As she looked at the dawn-gray basin, the sun lifted over the far escarpment, illuminating a biscuit-coloured landscape of rocks and sand. And she noted how the sun of Arrakis appeared to leap over the horizon.
"It's because we want to hold it back," she thought. "Night is safer than day."
There came over her then a longing for a rainbow in this place that would never see rain.
"I must suppress such longings," she thought. "They're a weakness. I no longer can afford weaknesses."
Stilgar gripped her arm, pointed across the basin.
"There, there you see proper druses."
She looked where he pointed, saw movement. People on the basin floor scattering at the daylight into the shadows of the opposite cliff wall.
In spite of the distance, their movements were plain in the clear air. She lifted her binoculars from beneath her robe, focused the oil lenses on the distant people. Kerchiefs fluttered like a flight of multicolored butterflies.
"That is home," Stilgar said. "We will be there this night."
He stared across the basin, tugging at his mustache.
"My people stayed out over late working. That means there are no patrols about. I'll signal them later, and they'll prepare for us."
"Your people show good discipline," Jessica said.
She lowered the binoculars, saw that Stilgar was looking at them.
"They obey the preservation of the tribe," he said. "It is the way we choose among us for a leader. The leader is the one who is strongest, the one who brings water and security."
He lifted his attention to her face. She returned his stare, noted the whiteless eyes, the stained eye pits, the dust-rimmed beard and mustache, the line of the catch tube curving down from his nostrils into his stillsuit.
"Have I compromised your leadership by besting you, Stilgar?" she asked.
"You did not call me out," he said.
"It's important that the leader keep the respect of his troop," she said.
"Isn't a one of those sand lice I cannot handle," Stilgar said. "When you bested me, you bested us all. Now they hope to learn from you, the weirding way, and some are curious to see if you intend to call me out."
She weighed the implications.
"By besting you in formal battle?"
He nodded.
"I'd advise you against this, because they'd not follow you. You're not of the sand. They saw this in our night's passage."
"Practical people," she said.
"True enough."
He glanced at the basin.
"We know our needs, but not many are thinking deep thoughts now this close to home. We've been out overlong arranging to deliver our spice quota to the free traders for the Cursed Guild. May their faces be forever black."
Jessica stopped in the act of turning away from him, looked back up into his face.
"The Guild? What has the Guild to do with your spice?"
"It's Liet's command," Stilgar said. "We know the reason, but the taste of it sours us. We bribe the Guild with a monstrous payment in spice to keep our skies clear of satellites and such, that none may spy what we do to the face of Arrakis."
She weighed out her words, remembering that Paul had said this must be the reason Arrakeen's skies were clear of satellites.
"And what is it you do to the face of Arrakis that must not be seen?"
"We change it. Slowly, but with certainty, to make it fit for human life. Our generation will not see it, nor our children, nor our children's children, nor the grandchildren of their children, but it will come."
He stared with veiled eyes out over the basin.
"Open water, and tall green plants, and people walking freely without stillsuits."
"So that's the dream of this Liet Kynes," she thought.
And she said,
"Bribes are dangerous. They have a way of growing larger and larger."
"They grow," he said, "but the slow way is the safe way."
Jessica turned, looked out over the basin, trying to see it the way Stilgar was seeing it in his imagination. She saw only the greyed mustard stain of distant rocks and a sudden hazy motion in the sky above the cliffs.
"Ah," Stilgar said.
She thought at first it must be a patrol vehicle, then realized it was a mirage, another landscape hovering over the desert, sand and a distant wavering of greenery, and in the middle distance a long worm traveling the surface with what looked like Fremen robes fluttering on its back. The mirage faded.
"It would be better to ride," Stilgar said, "but we cannot permit a maker into this basin. Thus, we must walk again tonight."
Maker, their word for worm, she thought.
She measured the import of his words, the statement that they could not permit a worm into this basin. She knew what she had seen in the mirage, Fremen riding on the back of a giant worm. It took heavy control not to betray her shock at the implications.
"We must be getting back to the others," Stilgar said. "Else my people may suspect I dally with you. Some already are jealous that my hands tasted your loveliness when we struggled last night in Tourneau Basin."
"That will be enough of that," Jessica snapped.
"No offense," Stilgar said.
and his voice was mild.
Women among us are not taken against their will. And with you, he shrugged, even that convention isn't required.
You will keep in mind that I was a duke's lady, she said, but her voice was calmer.
As you wish, he said. It's time to seal off this opening, to permit relaxation of still-suit discipline. My people need to rest in comfort this day. Their families will give them little rest on the morrow.
Silence fell between them. Jessica stared out into the sunlight. She had heard what she had heard in Stilgar's voice, the unspoken offer of more than his countenance. Did he need a wife? She realized she could step into that place with him. It would be one way to end conflict over tribal leadership, female properly aligned with male. But what of Paul, then? Who could tell yet what rules of parenthood prevailed here? And what of the unborn daughter she had carried these few weeks? What of a dead duke's daughter? And she permitted herself to face fully the significance of this other child growing within her, to see her own motives in permitting the conception. She knew what it was. She had succumbed to that profound drive shared by all creatures who are faced with death, the drive to seek immortality through progeny. The fertility drive of the species had overpowered them. Jessica glanced at Stilgar, saw that he was studying her, waiting. A daughter born here to a woman wed to such a one as this man. What would be the fate of such a daughter? She asked herself. Would he try to limit the necessities that a Bene Gesserit must follow? Stilgar cleared his throat and revealed then that he understood some of the questions in her mind.
What is important for a leader is that which makes him a leader. It is the needs of his people. If you teach me your powers, there may come a day when one of us must challenge the other. I would prefer some alternative.
There are several alternatives? She asked.
The Sayadina, he said. Our Reverend Mother is old.
Their Reverend Mother? Before she could probe this, he said,
I do not necessarily offer myself as mate. This is nothing personal, for you are beautiful and desirable. But should you become one of my women, that might lead some of my young men to believe that I'm too much concerned with pleasures of the flesh and not enough concerned with the tribe's needs. Even now they listen to us and watch us.
A man who weighs his decisions, who thinks of consequences, she thought.
There are those among my young men who have reached the age of wild spirits, he said. They must be eased through this period. I must leave no great reasons around for them to challenge me, because I would have to maim and kill among them. This is not the proper course for a leader if it can be avoided with honor. A leader, you see, is one of the things that distinguishes a mob from a people. He maintains the level of individuals. Too few individuals and a people reverts to a mob.
His words, the depth of their awareness, the fact that he spoke as much to her as to those who secretly listened, forced her to reevaluate him. He has stature, she thought. Where did he learn such inner balance?
The law that demands our form of choosing a leader is a just law, Stilgar said, but it does not follow that justice is always the thing a people needs. What we truly need now is time to grow and prosper, to spread our force over more land.
What is his ancestry? She wondered. Whence comes such breeding? She said, Stilgar, I underestimated you.
Such was my suspicion, he said.
Each of us apparently underestimated the other, she said.
I should like an end to this, he said. I should like friendship with you. And trust. I should like that respect for each other which grows in the breast without demand for the huddlings of sex.
I understand, she said.
Do you trust me?
I hear your sincerity.
Among us, he said, the Sayadina, when they are not the formal leaders, hold a special place of honor. They teach, they maintain the strength of God here.
He touched his breast. Now I must probe this Reverend Mother mystery, she thought. And she said, You spoke of your Reverend Mother, and I've heard words of legend and prophecy.
It is said that a Bene Gesserit and her offspring hold the key to our future, he said.
Do you believe I am that one?
She watched his face, thinking, the young reed dies so easily. Beginnings are times of such great peril.
We do not know, he said.
She nodded, thinking, he's an honorable man. He wants a sign from me, but he'll not tip fate by telling me the sign. Jessica turned her head, stared down into the basin at the golden shadows, the purple shadows, the vibrations of dust mote air across the lip of their cave. Her mind was filled suddenly with feline prudence. She knew the cant of the Missionaria Protectiva, knew how to adapt the techniques of legend and fear and hope to her emergency needs, but she sensed wild changes here, as though someone had been in among these Fremen and capitalized on the Missionaria Protectiva's imprint. Stilgar cleared his throat. She sensed his impatience, knew that the day moved ahead and men waited to seal off this opening. This was a time for boldness on her part. And she realized what she needed, some Dar al-Hikman, some school of translation that would give her adab, she whispered. Her mind felt as though it had rolled over within her. She recognized the sensation with a quickening of pulse. Nothing in all the Bene Gesserit training carried such a signal of recognition. It could be only the adab, the demanding memory that comes upon you of itself. She gave herself up to it, allowing the words to flow from her.
Ibn Kertaiba, she said, as far as the spoil where the dust ends.
She reached out an arm from her robe, seeing Stilgar's eyes go wide. She heard a rustling of many robes in the background.
I see a Fremen with a book of examples, she intoned. He reads to Allat, the son whom he defied and subjugated. He reads to the Sadhus of the trial, and this is what he reads. Mine enemies are like green blades eaten down, that did stand in the path of the tempest. Hast thou not seen what our Lord did? He sent the pestilence among them that did lay schemes against us. They are like birds scattered by the huntsman. Their schemes are like pellets of poison that every mouth rejects.
A trembling passed through her. She dropped her arm. Back to her from the inner cave's shadows came a whispered response of many voices.
Their works have been overturned. The fire of God mount over thy heart, she said, and she thought, now it goes in the proper channel. The fire of God set alight, came the response.
She nodded.
Thine enemies shall fall, she said. Bilal Kaifa, they answered.
In the sudden hush, Stilgar bowed to her.
Sayanina, he said, if the Shai Hulud grant, then you may yet pass within to become a reverend mother.
Pass within, she thought. An odd way of putting it. But the rest of it fitted into the cant well enough. And she felt a cynical bitterness at what she had done.
Our Missionaria Protectiva seldom fails. A place was prepared for us in this wilderness. The prayer of the Salat has carved out our hiding place. Now I must play the part of Alia, the friend of God. Sayadina to rogue peoples who've been so heavily imprinted with our Bene Gesserit soothsay, they even call their chief priestesses Reverend Mothers.
Paul stood beside Chaney in the shadows of the inner cave. He could still taste the morsel she had fed him, bird flesh and grain bound with spice honey and encased in a leaf. In tasting it, he had realized he never before had eaten such a concentration of spice essence, and there had been a moment of fear. He knew what this essence could do to him, the spice change that pushed his mind into prescient awareness.
Bilal Kaifa,
Chaney whispered. He looked at her, seeing the awe with which the Fremen appeared to accept his mother's words. Only the man called Jamis seemed to stand aloof from the ceremony, holding himself apart with arms folded across his breast.
Dwi yakain manje,
Chaney whispered. Tuipumain manche. I have two eyes. I have two feet.
And she stared at Paul with a look of wonder. Paul took a deep breath, trying to still the tempest within him. His mother's words had locked onto the working of the spice essence, and he had felt her voice rise and fall within him like the shadows of an open fire. Through it all, he had sensed the edge of cynicism in her. He knew her so well. But nothing could stop this thing that had begun with a morsel of food. Terrible purpose. He sensed it. The race consciousness that he could not escape. There was the sharpened clarity, the inflow of data, the cold precision of his awareness. He sank to the floor, sitting with his back against rock, giving himself up to it. Awareness flowed into that timeless stratum where he could view time, sensing the available paths, the winds of the future, the winds of the past. The one-eyed vision of the past, the one-eyed vision of the present, and the one-eyed vision of the future, all combined in a trinocular vision that permitted him to see time become space. There was danger, he felt, of overrunning himself, and he had to hold on to his awareness of the present, sensing the blurred deflection of experience, the flowing moment, the continual solidification of that which is into the perpetual was. In grasping the present, he felt for the first time the massive steadiness of time's movement, everywhere complicated by shifting currents, waves, surges and counter-surges, like surf against rocky cliffs. It gave him a new understanding of his prescience, and he saw the source of blind time, the source of error in it, with an immediate sensation of fear. The prescience, he realized, was an illumination that incorporated the limits of what it revealed, at once a source of accuracy and meaningful error. A kind of Heisenberg indeterminacy intervened. The expenditure of energy that revealed what he saw changed what he saw. And what he saw was a time nexus within this cave, a boiling of possibilities focused here, wherein the most minute action, the wink of an eye, a careless word, a misplaced grain of sand, moved a gigantic lever across the known universe. He saw violence with the outcomes subject to so many variables that his slightest movement created vast shiftings in the pattern. The vision made him want to freeze into immobility, but this, too, was action with its consequences. The countless consequences lines fanned out from this cave, and along most of these consequence lines, he saw his own dead body, with blood flowing from a gaping knife wound.
My father, the Padishah Emperor, was 72, yet looked no more than 35 the year he encompassed the death of Duke Leto and gave Arrakis back to the Harkonnens. He seldom appeared in public wearing other than a Sardaukar uniform and a Berserk's black helmet with the imperial lion in gold upon its crest. The uniform was an open reminder of where his power lay. He was not always that blatant, though. When he wanted, he could radiate charm and sincerity. But I often wonder in these later days if anything about him was as it seemed. I think now he was a man fighting constantly to escape the bars of an invisible cage. You must remember that he was an emperor, father head of a dynasty that reached back into the dimmest history. But we denied him a legal son. Was this not the most terrible defeat a ruler ever suffered? My mother obeyed her sister superiors, whether Lady Jessica disobeyed. Which of them was the stronger? History already has answered. In my father's house, by the Princess Irulan.
Jessica awakened in cave darkness, sensing the stir of Fremen around her, smelling the acrid, still-suit odor. Her inner time sense told her it would soon be night outside, but the cave remained in blackness, shielded from the desert by the plastic hoods that trapped their body moisture within this space. She realized that she had permitted herself the utterly relaxing sleep of great fatigue, and this suggested something of her own unconscious assessment on personal security within Stilgar's troop. She turned in the hammock that had been fashioned of her robe, slipped her feet to the rock floor and into her desert boots. I must remember to fasten the boots slip fashion to help my stillsuit's pumping action, she thought. There are so many things to remember. She could still taste their morning meal, the morsel of bird flesh and grain bound within a leaf with spice honey, and it came to her that the use of time was turned around here. Night was the day of activity, and day was the time of rest. Night conceals. Night is safest. She unhooked her robe from its hammock pegs in a rock alcove, fumbled with the fabric in the dark until she found the top, slipped into it. How to get a message out to the Bene Gesserit, she wondered. They would have to be told of the two strays in Arakeen Sanctuary. Glow globes came alight farther into the cave. She saw people moving there, Paul among them already dressed and with his hood thrown back to reveal the aquiline Atreides profile. He had acted so strangely before they retired, she thought. Withdrawn. He was like one come back from the dead, not yet fully aware of his return, his eyes half shut and glassy with the inward stare. It made her think of his warning about the spice-impregnated diet. Addictive. Are there side effects? She wondered. He said it had something to do with his prescient faculty, but he has been strangely silent about what he sees. Stilgar came from shadows to her right, crossed to the group beneath the glow globes. She marked how he fingered his beard and the watchful, cat-stalking look of him. Abrupt fear shot through Jessica as her senses awakened to the tensions visible in the people gathered around Paul, the stiff movements, the ritual positions.
They have my countenance, Stilgar rumbled.
Jessica recognized the man Stilgar confronted, Jameis. She saw then the rage in Jameis, the tight set of his shoulders.
Jameis, the man Paul bested, she thought.
You know the rules, Stilgar, Jameis said. Who knows it better? Stilgar asked.
And she heard the tone of placation in his voice, the attempt to smooth something over.
I choose the combat, Jameis growled.
Jessica sped across the cave, grasped Stilgar's arm. What is this? She asked.
It's the Amtal rule, Stilgar said. Jameis is demanding the right to test your part in the legend. She must be championed, Jameis said. If her champion wins, that's the truth in it. But it's said, he glanced across the press of people, that she'd need no champion from the Fremen, which can mean only that she brings her own champion.
He's talking of single combat with Paul, Jessica thought.
She released Stilgar's arm, took a half step forward.
I'm always my own champion, she said. The meaning's simple enough for...
You will not tell us our ways, Jameis snapped. Not without more proof than I've seen. Stilgar could have told you what to say last morning. He could have filled your mind full of the coddle, and you could have bird-talked it to us, hoping to make a false way among us.
I can take him, Jessica thought. But that might conflict with the way they interpret the legend.
And again she wondered at the way the Missionaria Protectiva's work had been twisted on this planet. Stilgar looked at Jessica, spoke in a low voice, but one designed to carry to the crowd's fringe.
Jameis is one to hold a grudge, Sayadina. Your son bested him, and... It was an accident, Jameis roared. There was rich force at Tuono Basin, and I'll prove it now. And I've bested him myself, Stilgar continued. He seeks by this Tahadi challenge to get back at me as well. There's too much of violence in Jameis for him ever to make a good leader. Too much Goffler, the distraction. He gives his mouth to the rules and his heart to the Safa, the turning away. No, he could never make a good leader. I've preserved him this long because he's useful in a fight as such, but when he gets this carving anger on him, he's dangerous to his own society. Stilgar, Jameis rumbled.
And Jessica saw what Stilgar was doing, trying to enrage Jameis to take the challenge away from Paul. Stilgar faced Jameis, and again Jessica heard the soothing in the rumbling voice.
Jameis, he's but a boy. He's... You named him a man, Jameis said. His mother says he's been through the Gorm Jabbar. He's full-fleshed and with a surfeit of water.
The ones who carried their pack say there's litajons of water in it. Litajons! And us sipping our catch pockets the instant they show dew sparkle.
Stilgar glanced at Jessica.
Is this true? Is there water in your pack?
Yes.
Litajons of it?
2 litajons.
What was intended with this wealth?
Wealth? She thought. She shook her head, feeling the coldness in his voice.
Where I was born, water fell from the sky and ran over the land in wide rivers, she said. There were oceans of it so broad you could not see the other shore. I've not been trained to your water discipline. I've never before had to think of it this way.
A sighing gasp arose from the people around them.
Water fell from the sky? It ran over the land?
Did you know there are those among us who've lost from their catch pockets by accident and will be in sore trouble before we reach Tabor this night?
How could I know?
Jessica shook her head.
If they're in need, give them water from our pack.
Is that what you intended with this wealth?
I intended it to save life, she said.
Then we accept your blessing, Sayadina.
You'll not buy us off with water,
Jamis growled. Nor will you anger me against yourself, Stilgar. I see you trying to make me call you out before I've proved my words.
Stilgar faced Jamis.
Are you determined to press this fight against a child, Jamis?
His voice was low, venomous.
She must be championed, even though she has my countenance.
I invoke the Amtal rule, Jamis said. It's my right.
Stilgar nodded.
Then, if the boy does not carve you down, you'll answer to my knife afterward. And this time I'll not hold back the blade as I've done before.
You cannot do this thing, Jessica said. Paul's just...
You must not interfere, Sayadina, Stilgar said. Oh, I know you can take me, and therefore can take anyone among us, but you cannot best us all united. This must be. It is the Omtal rule.
Jessica fell silent, staring at him in the green light of the glow globes, seeing the demoniacal stiffness that had taken over his expression. She shifted her attention to Jamis, saw the brooding look to his brows, and thought,
I should have seen that before. He broods. He's the silent kind, one who works himself up inside. I should have been prepared. If you harm my son, she said, you'll have me to meet. I call you out now. I'll carve you into a joint of...
Mother,
Paul stepped forward, touched her sleeve.
Perhaps if I explain to Jamis how...
Explain?
Jamis sneered. Paul fell silent, staring at the man. He felt no fear of him. Jamis appeared clumsy in his movements, and he had fallen so easily in their night encounter on the sand. But Paul still felt the nexus boiling of this cave, still remembered the prescient visions of himself, dead under a knife. There had been so few avenues of escape for him in that vision. Stilgar said,
Sayadina, you must step back now, where...
Stop calling her Sayadina, Jamis said. That's yet to be proved. So she knows the prayer. What's that? Every child among us knows it.
He has talked enough, Jessica thought. I've the key to him. I could immobilize him with a word.
She hesitated.
But I cannot stop them all. You will answer to me, then, Jessica said, and she pitched her voice in a twisting tone with a little whine in it and a catch at the end.
Jamis stared at her, fright visible on his face.
I'll teach you the agony, she said in the same tone. Remember that as you fight. You'll have agony such as will make the Gomjabar a happy memory by comparison. You will writhe with your entire...
She tries a spell on me,
Jamis gasped.
He put his clenched right fist beside his ear.
I invoke the silence on her.
So be it then,
Stilgar said. He cast a warning glance at Jessica.
If you speak again, Sayadina, we'll know it's your witchcraft and you'll be forfeit.
He nodded for her to step back. Jessica felt hands pulling her, helping her back, and she sensed they were not unkindly. She saw Paul being separated from the throng, the elfin-faced Chaney whispering in his ear as she nodded toward Jamis. A ring formed within the troop. More glow globes were brought, and all of them tuned to the yellow band. Jamis stepped into the ring, slipped out of his robe, and tossed it to someone in the crowd.
He stood there in a cloudy, grey slickness of still suit that was patched and marked by tucks and gathers. For a moment he bent with his mouth to his shoulder, drinking from a catch pocket tube. Presently he straightened, peeled off, and detached the suit, handed it carefully into the crowd. He stood waiting, clad in loincloth and some tight fabric over his feet, a Chris knife in his right hand. Jessica saw the girl child Cheney helping Paul, saw her press a Chris knife handle into his palm, saw him heft it, testing the weight and balance. And it came to Jessica that Paul had been trained in prana and bindu, the nerve and the fibre, that he had been taught fighting in a deadly school, his teachers, men like Duncan Idaho and Gurney Halleck, men who were legends in their own lifetimes. The boy knew the devious ways of the Bene Gesserit, and he looked supple and confident. "But he's only 15," she thought, "and he has no shield. I must stop this. Somehow there must be a way to—" She looked up, saw Stilgar watching her.
"You cannot stop it," he said. "You must not speak."
She put a hand over her mouth, thinking, "I've planted fear in Jameis's mind. It'll slow him some, perhaps. If I could only pray, truly pray." Paul stood alone now, just into the ring, clad in the fighting trunks he'd worn under his still suit. He held a Chris knife in his right hand, his feet were bare against the sand-gritted rock. Idaho had warned him time and again, "When in doubt of your surface, bare feet are best." And there were Cheney's words of instruction still in the front of his consciousness.
"Jameis turns to the right with his knife after a parry. It's a habit in him we've all seen, and he'll aim for the eyes to catch a blink in which to slash you. And he can fight either hand. Look out for a knife shift."
But strongest in Paul, so that he felt it with his entire body, was training and the instinctual reaction mechanism that had been hammered into him day after day, hour after hour on the practice floor. Gurney Halleck's words were there to remember.
"The good knife fighter thinks on point and blade and shearing guard simultaneously. The point can also cut. The blade can also stab. The shearing guard can also trap your opponent's blade."
Paul glanced at the Chris knife. There was no shearing guard, only the slim, round ring of the handle with its raised lips to protect the hand. And even so, he realized that he did not know the breaking tension of this blade, did not even know if it could be broken. Jameis began sidling to the right along the edge of the ring opposite Paul. Paul crouched, realizing then that he had no shield but was trained to fighting with its subtle field around him, trained to react on defense with utmost speed while his attack would be timed to the controlled slowness necessary for penetrating the enemy's shield. In spite of constant warning from his trainers not to depend on the shield's mindless blunting of attack speed, he knew that shield awareness was part of him. Jameis called out in ritual challenge,
"May thy knife chip and shatter."
This knife will break then, Paul thought. He cautioned himself that Jameis also was without shield, but the man wasn't trained to its use, had no shield fighter inhibitions. Paul stared across the ring at Jameis. The man's body looked like knotted whipcord on a dried skeleton. His Chris knife shone milky yellow in the light of the glow globes. Fear coursed through Paul. He felt suddenly alone and naked, standing in dull yellow light within this ring of people. Prescience had fed his knowledge with countless experiences, hinted at the strongest currents of the future and the strings of decision that guided them, but this was the real now. This was death hanging on an infinite number of minuscule mischances. Anything could tip the future here, he realized. Someone coughing in the troop of watchers, a distraction, a variation in a glow globe's brilliance, a deceptive shadow.
"I'm afraid," Paul told himself.
And he circled warily opposite Jameis, repeating silently to himself the Bene Gesserit litany against fear.
"Fear is the mind killer."
It was a cool bath washing over him. He felt muscles untie themselves, become poised and ready.
"I'll sheath my knife in your blood," Jameis snarled,
and in the middle of the last word he pounced. Jessica saw the motion, stifled an outcry.
Where the man struck, there was only empty air, and Paul stood now behind Jameis with a clear shot at the exposed back.
"Now, Paul, now!"
Jessica screamed it in her mind. Paul's motion was slowly timed, beautifully fluid, but so slow it gave Jameis the margin to twist away, backing and turning to the right. Paul withdrew, crouching low.
"First,